Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. One of my absolute favorite guests, of course, Utah Jazz play-by-play announcer on the radio, also host of Locked On Jazz and the Locked On NBA podcast, where he has far better guests than I do. David Locke, how you doing?
All right, now, I either take that as a compliment, or since I'm your guest, you've just said that every one of my guests is better than me.
Well, you did have Zach Harper on today, right? So that's a
I did, and I have the and I have the coach as well. So you know, my guests sometimes I can't even call them by name, which means you know who knows. But I
no,
like
you know, it's funny. My lawyer's mind, as soon as I said that, realized that oh wait a minute, like he's a guest on my show, and now I'm impugning him. I didn't mean to do that, but I figured that nobody else would be as arcane as me to actually catch it. But you did immediately. So well, this is why we get along.
Well, this is also because so I always thought I was going to be a lawyer, and then I was actually smart enough to not go to law school and just go straight into broadcasting. You just went to law school, have the hoity-toity title, are so impressive, have a far better fallback plan than I do if something goes wrong, but frankly had to go to law school and be a lawyer.
Oh man, I've like completely forgotten everything about just like the day-to-day of being a lawyer. It's only been like a year and a half too. If I had to go back it would be a disaster.
How many happy lawyers do you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. My mom is very happy. She's been an insurance lawyer in Chicago for over 40 years. She really liked it. She was part of the reason I went to law school. I mean, I was a happy lawyer. I just like this better. You know, it wasn't, I mean, I think compared to most people, but yeah, they're definitely, I think the biggest issue in the law is just other lawyers are so annoying and miserable that, you know, whether it's the people you're working for, you know, there's a certain type of personality that leads you to make partner in a big law firm. And then if you're an associate working for that type of personality, you might be pretty miserable. And then, you know, having to deal with opposing counsel all the time, who just are incredibly intransigent a lot of the time, could be pretty stressful for a lot of people too.
I didn't go to law school, so I don't know what that word meant that you used there.
It means they never agree for any reason, which hopefully will be the theme of this podcast for us too. Or maybe maybe that'll be the home and home on your podcast, which we're about
to. I have had some significant disagreements over our times when we've done these before.
No, it's and I like it when instead of you just saying, huh, that's interesting, which is what you usually do when you disagree, you actually like fire back. We encourage that here.
All right, I'm ready. I'm revved up. I'll fire back when necessary.
Well, so where I wanted to start here is just some general NBA stuff. You're a keen observer of the league. You watch a ton of games. You watch a ton of games live. You're also have, you know, you're around the team more. So I think you, both in terms of the game and in terms of just seeing how teams operate, you have a unique perspective. So I wanted to ask you just like, what have you learned about basketball this year and about the NBA this year, just in general? Have you reached any conclusions about, hey, you know what, like I just came to the conclusion that this works or this doesn't work, or hey, this is something that I never realized was so important or so unimportant?
I think that so by being around the team every day, I'm taking your question a little bit differently, but I'd say the two things that I think I've learned most by being around a team every day that fights against kind of my analytical belief of loving to look at the NBA analytically, and that when I see things on Twitter from people, I'm like, gosh, like that doesn't work that way, is one that no decision is 100% 0%.
Yeah.
And I think we all act like when the coach makes it, oh my gosh, how could he possibly do that? Well, like it was probably 51-49 or 55-45 or 60-40. And then part two of that is that there are a lot of times in which, because the second thing is that no decision is made in a capsule, they're all made with a team dynamic involved or an 82 game schedule involved, that there are times when it's absolutely appropriate to take the 40% choice on the 60-40.
Yeah, and I think not only that, is there a 60-40 sometimes, it's that even if you make the wrong decision, the nature of the game is just that sometimes things are going to work out well, right? If you call a terrible play as a coach and your team ends up shooting a really bad isolation jumper, that's still a 30% shot that goes in. So it's really possible to be rewarded for bad decisions a lot of times, more than perhaps we're willing to acknowledge.
Well, and I think, so what you're talking about is more like like I was thinking more of rotational items or
or
things of just how you're, you know, how you might be running a player, close out a game or something.
You put it, you put in the worst player and, you know, he just happens to heat up and make a few shots that night. You know, it could just be something like that too.
And the one Quinn Snyder talks about all the time that he I think had to kind of teach himself along the way is, you know, he's like, any coach that says they're not second guessing every decision they make, whether it works or not, is not telling the truth. He says that the problem you have to remind yourself as a coach is that just because what you chose didn't work doesn't mean the other was going to either.
Yeah, that's a good point too. You could have, and you can also just be over justifying your decisions by saying, hey, you know, we had the right process here and rely on that, as opposed to, you know, hey, maybe we really need to fix this. So especially even in a long season like this with 82 games, there are just so many factors that evaluating your decision making. Now, I think that's actually much harder for coaches than it is for front office. I think front office, you kind of have a larger sample size, you have a larger scope. I think compared to coaching, I think that the front office in a lot of ways can be easier, especially because you're not really on the ground. You don't have your boots on the ground to where you have to manage some of the egos involved as much.
Right. And then, so a little bit of what I think you're talking about there is the other thing I've started to kind of clue into around the league. I think there are pre-March coaching decisions and post-March 1 coaching decisions. So pre-March 1 coaching decisions are all based on trade deadline, 82 games, maintaining a schedule, maintaining a locker room, maintaining options, maintaining player development, allowing for different player development to happen, like giving guys chances to play through mistakes. And then March 1 is either your franchise takes the turn where it's not going for the playoffs, so then you just play all your young kids and you just ignore winning to some extent and you just develop, or two, you start to worry a little less on some of keeping everybody involved and you start to narrow down your rotation and get your team playoff ready. And so I think in that sense, as a coach, that's where it's really much more difficult, in the sense that you're playing the whole 82 game schedule. Now, from a front office, the one thing I think is really eye-opening to me with some insight on things is how many chances you have at something. So if you even think about the Jazz trading for George Hill, like, I think that had probably been discussed numerous times before, and you probably think, oh, the door closed on that. Yeah, eventually it opens, right? Or if you keep those conversations. And maybe there's other times where you had one window to get a player and you didn't jump on it, and then you never get another chance to get him. I think that's the most interesting thing. Like PJ Tucker Toronto, I thought was like probably the best move by anybody at the trade deadline, frankly, other than maybe Sacramento trading DeMarcus Cousins.
Certainly for this year. Oh, yeah. I mean, Cousins, it's interesting because I've actually come closer to your view on Cousins than you know, the conventional wisdom maybe. But maybe that's something we could hit on a little bit later. Yeah, I thought it just as far as improving this year, yeah, it probably was that PJ Tucker move. Toronto's awesome on D all of a sudden.
And I look at the other playoff teams, there's a bunch of teams that all of a sudden, if you ask them now on March 15th instead of, or March 25th instead of February, whatever it was, I think we suddenly really need PJ Tucker, right? Like, actually, the Jazz suddenly need PJ Tucker, you know, like a bunch of guys that expected to be playing well aren't playing well, and suddenly they could have used him, and I think the Rockets could probably use him a little bit more than they thought they could have, and it's interesting how time evolves on that one as well.
No, that's a good point, and you know, maybe some of the teams that didn't make moves as well, you could look at Atlanta, who we talked about on my show quite a bit as a team that, hey, they're the 4 seed in the East. They're 10 games over 500. Yeah, I know Paul Millsap's a free agent. We can't break this team up. And now, you know, it looks like they are going to struggle to even get into the playoffs, and they're going to be, you know, first round fodder most likely.
Yeah, they're really quite something right now. I mean, I'm not, Detroit's got to be thinking, we might be able to catch Atlanta. Like, and Atlanta's in the 5th spot and then Detroit's in the 10th.
Yeah, they might be out of it after yesterday. So one of the things that I've come to a conclusion of, this is a lot more hyper-specific than what you're talking about, was I think that, you know, it used to be, hey, ice the pick and roll, drop back under the basket, that's the way to do it, force mid-range jumpers, that's how pretty much just about every NBA team should be playing defense. And I think I've seen it both with the Nuggets and the Warriors in particular, that if you have a less athletic center, you're almost better off in some ways bringing him up to just prevent the initial penetration to begin with, than you are, because if you have that guy hang back, that, you know, or maybe if you have like a Nikola Vucevic type, or even Enes Kanter would be another one, although you may dispute that given your experience with him, but to actually just bring that guy up and say, all right, now you're not going to turn the corner. You got to throw a tough pass to the roll guy. You got to throw a long pass to the other side rather than just letting a guard get ahead of steam at that guy just under the rim where he's not going to be able to do anything. Maybe that's actually a better way to do it. What do you think of that?
I try maybe too hard to be contrary to this. I never like when we think, and we being this kind of this basketball media, which I do think has a little bit of a collective brain, when we decide to determine that there's one way things should be done. Because I just think that's really fault. I think there's different times where things should be done. I think there's different ways to approach things, and there's personnel issues. I mean, I actually even go back to a conversation I had with Rob Mahoney once where I was really defending some things that Tyrone Corbin did, and there were areas in that conversation where I probably overly defended Ty, but there was also areas where Rob really killed Ty in an article where Ty had tried a lot of the things Rob was saying and they didn't work. Now what he was doing right now also didn't work. Well, that's because Al Jefferson just couldn't defend, right? Like, it didn't, you know, it really didn't matter what he did. And so on some of these things, you know, Terry Stotts is a huge believer in dropping the big, right? It was fabulous with Robin Lopez, and then it became not very good with Plumlee for a year. Well, that's a personnel thing, not a scheme thing, and I'm not sure that changing that scheme was right. So I guess I never bought the group think that you had to drop the big into the lane. When we do it a lot with Gobert, if you have Rudy, that's incredible defense. But sure, on certain teams, it doesn't work. And frankly, we're thought of as a drop the big team. And I know plenty of times where our defensive scheme has changed for the night and our big is supposed to play it a little differently. I don't know how many people notice it, but we don't play it the same way every night. So I guess I just don't buy the group think into one philosophy. So I think you're right that you've noticed that there's something different. And I think the premise by which you were coming from was probably all of us being flawed.
Yeah. All right. We'll be back with more from David Locke right after this word.
Do wear contact lenses. My girlfriend does, and she was quite pleased that we got Hubble Contacts as a sponsor. What if I told you that you can get a pair of fresh lenses for every single day for $30 a month? That's $1 a day, half the price of other daily brands. If you go to HubbleContacts.com, you can get your first 2 weeks free. Signing up is incredibly easy. It took me maybe 45 seconds to do it for my girlfriend. All she did was just text me her prescription. I put it in, and about a week later, the contacts started arriving. It was fantastic. How is Hubble able to give you daily contacts so much less expensively than the other guys? Well, contacts are expensive because four companies control 97% of the market. Hubble sells directly to you, so they can offer their contacts for half the price, no markups going through your optometrist or anything else. And they can even send you to an optometrist if you don't have a prescription today. Getting contacts is never been more convenient and affordable. No more overpaying, overwearing, easy on the eyes and the wallet. They're recently featured in a BuzzFeed article of 7 new products that will change your life. And to get started with them, you can go to HubbleContacts.com to get your first 2 weeks of lenses for free. You can't beat this deal. 2 free weeks of contacts at HubbleContacts.com. That's H-U-B-B-L-E Contacts.com.
So I wanted to shift to...
No. So you went to commercial break because you were pissed about my answer. I know that. You went to commercial break because you were mad about my answer.
What was to be mad about it? I thought it was...
I don't know.
I mean, you pretty much agreed with me. No, I basically was just like, all right, we only have limited time. I wanted to get to the Jazz and, right. Oh, wait, I have to make some money. I totally forgot. I better get this in right now.
Hey, I'm all for podcasts making money. Let's not kid ourselves. Multiple podcasts making money. I'm all for it.
I want to talk about Derek Favors first. And he was someone who, this time last year, maybe a little bit before then, if you looked at who the best player on the Jazz was, there's a legitimate argument that he was actually maybe their best player. Now, Gordon Hayward and Rudy Gobert have both taken such enormous steps forward this year that that probably wouldn't be an argument even if he were at his former level. But he, of course, has struggled. It's kind of been a lost year for him. I was encouraged by, you know, what I saw from him maybe around early February or so. He looked a little bit more spry, but then, you know, he's now been shut down again. But is he really... is he important to this team at this point? Is he really essential to what they're trying to do? Or is it just, hey, this guy, you know, he's a good player, but he's kind of a combo big. And you know, especially if he's not going to have like his absolute peak athleticism, you know, that maybe he doesn't fit into the modern game that well.
So if you go back a year ago to exactly what you're talking about, a year ago, he destroys DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis in in like close to back-to-back games. He has 28-14-4-3 against Cousins. And he has 28-11-3-6 blocks against Davis. I think they were both early March. That's 12 months ago. Like, that guy, that player, holy smokes if we had that player. Is he essential to Jazz? Absolutely. When he and Gobert are on the floor together, the Jazz defensive rating is 96.5. You can talk to me about how cumbersome an offense is, how non-modern big spaced it is, how much of a pain it is for Quinn Snyder to try to get guys shots. All you got to do is be better than 96.5, right? The worst offense in the NBA is 102, isn't it? 102?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the Sixers are worse than that, but yeah, it's okay. Pretty damn good is the point. Yeah.
So if you put the Jazz team out there and, you know, their average offensive team at about 105, 106, and you tell me, well, gosh, I think if you have Favors on the floor, you might be 10 or 15% less good offensively. Okay, that's fine, right? Like, I'm fine with that. Because we're still going to be plus 6, plus 7 with Favors. And I think, yes, he's vital. And even this year, that's, like, imagine if he was right. He hasn't been right all year. Now, here's part two of it. Here's what's happened to the Jazz recently. The Jazz with Gobert and Joe Johnson on the floor together. So that's the 4-5 combo. Are pretty good. Even since the All-Star break, when we've been struggling, they're still plus 4 for the season. They're plus 13. The defensive rating for the season's like a 102 recently. It's a 108.
It's just so tough to ask Joe Johnson to play like starters minutes, and not only starters minutes, but starters minutes at the 4 at this point in his career.
You nailed it. So you have probably at the most 20 minutes a night you can ask for that. You've got about 16 minutes a night you can get Gobert in Favors if he's right. So you still have to link together another 10 minutes a night. Okay. Without Favors, we got to link together 26 minutes a night of defensive prowess. We can't do it. We just don't have the personnel to do it. And so Favors is incredibly vital for this team, even if he's only playing 12 minutes with Gobert and 8 minutes as a center.
Yeah.
And without having that, you end up having big combinations on the floor like Joe Johnson and Jeff Withey's defensive rating since the All-Star break is 114, or Boris Diaw and Jeff Withey's defensive rating is also 114.
None of the power forwards on the team other than Favors really can stop anybody, I think. And they're good offensive players. But, you know, at this point, especially if those guys have to get out in the perimeter and guard, it's really hard for them.
And Trey Lyles has just not handled his sophomore season yet.
Yeah, I do actually have to take, I mean, I don't want to take a victory lap over someone not playing. But when we talked about, we did the preview and I was like, hey, I don't think Trey Lyles is going to play this year. And you pushed back on that. I think it's looked like you mentioned the after March 1st thing. And yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, he's not going to play over Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw. Like, it's just like, no coach really is going to make that decision, I think, at this point. And whether Lyles had a disappointing year or not, I think they're always going to just lean on the veterans when the going gets tough, it seems like.
I think they would have liked to have Trey Lyles play some of those 4 minutes and have Boris Diaw play some 5 minutes instead, and it just didn't work.
I haven't watched every Jazz game, but do they play Gordon Hayward at the four very much at all? And if not, why not?
So you'd have to decide if you believe that when Joe Ingles is in the game, and is he at the four or is Gordon at the four at that point?
Yeah, okay. Well, so I guess that's kind of the same thing, essentially. So you're saying that Joe is playing the four and that's...
Usually, I think by definition, it's Joe Ingles at the four, but you could just as easily claim that that's Gordon Hayward at the four.
Yeah, I guess you could. And then you would, I mean, because it's really a question of whether, like, Joe Ingles would be the guy who would be in there, and then you'd have Hood. But, you know, how many games have Hood and Hill also been healthy as well? I mean, I think, not to get lost in the shuffle here, how good the Jazz have been despite these crazy injuries that they've had. I mean, if you said that Derek Favors wasn't going to play, George Hill was going to miss, you know, a third, maybe even 40% of the season, I'm not sure exactly what it was, and be hampered part of the rest with this toe thing. I think to get to where they're at has actually been pretty impressive.
All right, so if I were to ask you, you might know this, but I'll ask the listener, how many games do you think the Jazz have had their starting lineup together this season?
I want to say like 13. Are they like 12-1 in those games or something like that?
Yeah, yep, they're 13 and their starting lineup, I think they might be 11-2. And one of the losses is the fourth game in 5 nights in Memphis. They're 11-2 in 13 games, and I believe their differential with that 5 on the floor is over plus 10. You know, we may never know how good this team was, but it might have been the third best team in the West. It might have been right up there with the Houston Rockets for the third best team in the West. We'll never know.
Yeah, that's a thought, because there's certainly a lot of variables this offseason. George Hill's free agency, Gordon Hayward's free agency, Favors being a free agent after next year, and the possibility that maybe that he could get moved. But what I wanted to ask you is, I know you don't have any really understanding of, you know, what Hayward's decision might be, but just from your knowing him, how much do you think the ultimate result of this Jazz season and how well they do in the playoffs would affect his decision to stay or leave?
Well, I don't think it can do anything but affect his decision, right? Like, that's like, I get that question a lot, and I'm taking it in a very literal sense that it has to affect his decision, because that's the last emotion you have with your team.
Yeah.
Right. And so that, I don't think that that can be underestimated, just that the last emotion you have, it's the opposite of Little Miss Sunshine, the movie. I thought that was a terrible movie with the greatest finish maybe of any movie I've ever watched. Like, it really, like, the end of Little Miss Sunshine might be like one of my seriously favorite cinematic moments. Like, you just can't feel better. Does that make it a good movie? What happens if, like, in sense of Gordon Hayward, so you take that the first part of his career was pretty miserable in Utah, they weren't good, and he didn't like his coach, you know, he didn't have a great coach, and I don't know if he liked him or not, but, you know, just the coaching didn't work. And the second set of has been fabulous. He became an all-star. His coach is brilliant. His training staff is fabulous. He's worked with assistant coaches beautifully. You know, like, does he put 7 years and just put it in a mosh pit and say, well, it's overall it's been? Does he take just the last 3 years when he analyzes it? Does he have enough scars from the first 3 years that he's just dying to leave?
And the fact that he had to go somewhere else to get a restricted free agent offer to get the max salary that he wanted.
Sure, right? That's probably a scar. Like, I think this is what's so interesting about free agency, is that he has the only team he has scars with are his own, right?
Yeah.
That's the same thing for Durant.
Right.
Durant had a lot of scars with Oklahoma City for whatever, you know, whether it's clear. Like, he left his exit out of Oklahoma City. He didn't do any of the good natured things back to OKC. So he had scars. I don't know what they are, but he had scars that were enough that you can tell from his behavior he did not leave loving the place. You know, that's just the reality of spending 7 years somewhere. You know, it's no different than a marriage.
Yeah, well, and especially when you get drafted in, as most stars do, to teams that aren't that good at the time. And I guess, I think the reason I asked, though, is that obviously the Jazz can offer him the most money and the most years. You'd have to imagine that unless something catastrophic happened, such an offer would be forthcoming. He could also make an All-NBA team and then maybe even opt into next year and then extend for that 5-year Mega Max extension. That's also something that it could be a possibility. But it's just...
The Jazz will pay Gordon what the market yields.
Yeah.
I mean, not what the market allows, not right. What it yields.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever they can, basically. Yeah,
they're going to pay it.
You know, it's interesting, though, just the question of, you know, is that important to him? Is just being in the absolute best possible place to win what's important to him? You know, I think that's kind of going to be the interesting question. I mean, just based on having known him for these years now, do you get an impression of just like what the factors are that would be most important to him? Just, you know, is it the security? Is it the money? Is it just the absolute best chance to win? What do you think?
I think 80% of it is being driven by winning.
Yeah.
He would say 100%. I'll say 80%, whether he realizes it or not. There are some other factors, right? Like, the question I have, like, so we were playing Washington. And we were great that day. We were in Washington. They'd lost one game at home in like 23. Jazz were terrific. I think everybody might have been healthy. We were up by 14. They make a run. You begin to feel like, uh-oh. Gets down to 6. Quinn calls timeout, calls a play for Gordon. He nails the top of the key jumper, run a beautiful step back. Next play, calls a play for Gordon, hits top of the circle 3. Game's over, right? And he, timeout, Scott Brooks, and Gordon's banging his chest, and, you know, he just won the game. Like, in Boston, those plays are called for Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah, anywhere that he goes where he's going to have a better chance of winning than in Utah, he's not going to be the main guy asked to score at the end of the game.
And I don't think that that is an overriding. That's why I say I think 80% is winning. But that has to factor in a little. I just can't imagine that that doesn't factor in. And maybe not enough, as I'm saying. I don't think it's 51%. I don't think he's a guy that has to be the man over winning. But I do think that has to factor in some percentage of the equation.
Last thing before I let you go, and then we immediately record your podcast. The matchup with the Clippers, that looks like it's pretty likely now that the Jazz are going to be locked into that, although there's still Oklahoma City may have some a little something to say about that.
I would say as we record this, I suspect we're going to be six.
Really? And is part of that because George Hill isn't going to play tonight and Favors is still out and just some of the injury issues?
We just don't have a lot of wins on our schedule left, right? We're in Sacramento tonight without George Hill, without Derek Favors. So you're playing without two starters. We're playing Washington on, and I think Gordon's going to play, but I'm not sure. We're going to play Washington on Friday, assuming we're going to be without those two probably again. I don't know that, but just I'm my post-traumatic jazz syndrome for the season is the fact that I just assume people are out. And then if you look at our schedule in our final six games, we have Portland twice, who we struggle to match up with, who are playing great. Minnesota once, Golden State once, and San Antonio twice. Like, how many wins are left on that schedule?
Yeah, three. You've been saying this, but for those who haven't seen it, you better root for the Warriors to win tonight against San Antonio and basically lock up that number one seed, so those two teams have nothing to play for.
Two weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, I said we were going to be seven. I thought we were going to tie with Memphis. I don't think Memphis can get us now. I think they've just dropped enough games that I don't think they'll get to us.
And they've been a 500 team for the last like 3 months too.
But their schedule, they don't play anybody.
Yeah.
Right. They have one more game against the Spurs. Other than that, I think they have a 70% win probability according to 538 on every game the rest of the way. So we could still. I mean, if we get to 48, which we probably should, I think we're six. If we get to 49, I think we could be fourth. If we get to 50, we're fourth, by the way.
Do you think if you take home court advantage out of the equation, you think there's a feeling for this team that they might almost rather play Houston than the Clippers just because of the way they've struggled so much against the Clippers these last 2 years?
It's a very logical comment just because of exactly what you said. I find it laughable if a team that has not made the playoffs and has no track record of performing in the playoffs starts talking about who they would rather play.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
I think if we're perfectly honest, I think most teams would rather play us. Wouldn't you rather play the Jazz than playing Russell Westbrook? Russell Westbrook has the capability of beating you four times out of seven.
If the Jazz were healthy, no, I would much rather play Oklahoma City. I think especially if you have a good defense, Oklahoma City is such a one-note team that, you know, if you're really game planning to stop their fast break and take away Westbrook, I think it's for him to be that efficient over a seven-game series, it seems unlikely to me.
Well, talk about where if we have both bigs healthy, you go and we talk, like, let's combine all of our conversations. Oh my gosh, you will be so impressed with this, our closing argument to the entire conversation, Mr. Lawyer, where we bring everything together. You will be so impressed by this. But if we bring together your question about Favors and we bring together your discussion about covering pick and rolls. Okay, so if you don't have Favors, you play the, and you have Westbrook, then you play the pick and rolls we have all year with him, which is you drop the big, you try to run him off the 3-point line and make him take one of his mid-range jumpers. And on two occasions this year, he got hot. And one time I think he was terrible and we've gone to the wire with him in every single game and he's made some plays to beat us. If you have Favors and you're in the pick and roll, you probably play some funny games with who's matching up with whom based on, one, you have Favors go out and guard the pick and roll and you have him either hedge the pick and roll or you have him play equal to the screen, because if Westbrook gets by, you don't care because you got Gobert.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I actually think the Jazz, when it's all really when healthy for the Jazz, you know, if there's going to be this team that George Hill is going to be struggling, Rodney Hood is going to be inconsistent, where you've basically kind of got Hayward and Gobert, and then, you know, frankly, some question marks. You know, the Jazz are pretty beatable. I think otherwise, you know, I actually really like their matchup a lot with Houston because of the ability for Gobert and, you know, George Hill or maybe Hood to play James Harden and whoever is setting the screen 2-on-2 in the pick and roll. I actually think that Utah is one of the best positioned teams in the league to defend Houston.
We have not defended them great. We have scored great against them. If you actually go look at the numbers of game by game offensive ratings, their offensive rating's been really high against us. We've been over 120 twice offensively.
Yeah, well, I think that's another thing too, is just Houston doesn't really have the discipline or the players to, you know, I don't think Ariza is at the point, like, he's not that, like, guy who's both quick and really strong that's going to give Hayward problems, you know, the way like a Butler or Mbah Mute, who actually is a wonderful defensive player. I mean, that's a reason why, you know, I think the Clippers give the Jazz some trouble. But I mean, I would give Utah, a healthy Utah team, a fighting chance in that series. I still think that, you know, Houston is just better than the Clippers, and that's maybe a reason why the Jazz would match up better with the Clippers. But, you know, for some of the reasons we talked about, I mean, can you, last thing before we go, can you elaborate on why it is that the Jazz have struggled against the Clippers so much, even in this year?
I think Mbah Mutah gives Gordon a hard time, and so that slows us down. Robertson, by the way, gives Gordon a hard time, so Oklahoma City's a bad matchup for us. So that's the first part. I think DeAndre Jordan takes away the Gobert role a little bit, and so then that's the second part. And then they're very physical. They grab and hold a lot, and we have a movement-based offense, and the officials don't call it, and so we can't get free. And then it particularly happens when we're in our second quarters. Have been particular. I think we're averaging 15 points a game in the second quarter against the Clippers this year.
All right, well, thanks for coming on. I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation in maybe about 5 minutes or so on your podcast. Don't forget about our sponsor for today, Hubble Contacts. Go to hubblecontacts.com. You can get 15 pairs of lenses for free. And then even after that, it's only $1 a day, $30 a month for a new pair of contacts every day. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to David for coming on, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Thanks to BetDSI for sponsoring today's show. March Madness is finally underway, and there's no better place to bet on games than BetDSI. Their live in-game wagering lets you make plays throughout entire games, at home or on the go. And now, in honor of March Madness, BetDSI is having a $1 million bracket contest for our listeners. You can get a free $25 credit just for registering, as well as a 200% bonus on your first deposit when you use the promo code DUNC25, D-U-N-C-25, at BetDSI.com.